Greetings, friends. This is John Haspel, and I am the Dhamma teacher at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. The podcast will begin in a moment. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for additional podcasts, Dhamma articles, and a calendar of our weekly classes and monthly and yearly retreats. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you find this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you, and enjoy the talk. So December 8th was Bodhi Day, which for most Buddhists we recognize as the day that the Buddha awakened. And we had our Bodhi Day celebration this past Saturday, which was a wonderful experience. Good food, a lot of wonderful people here, and some different presentations, and it went well. So I thought this week I would talk briefly about that again. I didn't talk much about it on Bodhi Day, about the significance of the Buddha's awakening. And I did a little edit of an article called A Prince Becomes a Buddha. I think I posted it just about a year ago, and I re-edited it, added a few little things, and put it out. How many people had a chance to read the article? Because I'm not going to read it. I didn't bring my Kindle anyway, but I didn't want to. I thought what I'd like to do is to start off with asking you if you have any questions about it. I know I talk a lot about the Buddha. He's a human being who, through his own efforts, awakened, and he presented this Dhamma. But are there any questions or things that you may not understand about the Buddha? Everybody's got it?
We're ready for the test.
No, well, I mean, there. When I first heard of the Buddha, he was a mythical and mystical superhuman something. I didn't even know how to categorize him. And that alone was confusing to me. Probably the most significant understanding that I've come to is that the Buddha was a human being who, through his own efforts, awakened. And because of that understanding, that allowed me to make some sense out of what he taught. Up until that point, it was a lot of mystical and mythical teachings. You know, and when you get into some, we talked a little bit about this earlier tonight, that some of the modern schools of Buddhism are completely mystical, and they're completely other realm. They have no application to day-to-day human life. And again, that's not that wasn't what the Buddha was after. The Buddha did not, well, at least he had...
I did. You know, I was thinking, John, I guess I understand I understand to the best of my ability to understand the four principles and the eightfold path. And I guess where I get a little stuck in is how, and it kind of takes off from the conversation we had last week, actually, that I think it was last week I was here, about how he actually engaged in life helping others. Like, I know he taught. Like, I understand that principle of his teachings and what was written about his teachings. But where I start to think is, I still have to think he was humanitarian. It just sounds like that was another driving piece. I was wondering how he was able to
That's such an important question, Lisa. Because the Ratana Sutta explains that very well. How the Buddha dealt with social problems. And so trying to think of the town. I can't think of it just this moment. But there was a town in northern India. You know, the Buddha spent his whole life just walking around northern India. He never left a 400 square mile area. You know, that was his whole gig was right there. But he was always on the move, except for rainy season, and they would stay put for 3 months. So he came across a village right on the tip of my tongue. that had been devastated by a few things. Some were ecological. There were some floods. They had lost, there was also a drought before that, and they lost their crops. Disease had taken over the town. The town was just a mess, dead bodies everywhere. Just before the Buddha got there, there was another torrential rain, and that helped clean up the town a little bit. You know, it sounds pretty gross, but it washed some of the dead bodies away. So the Buddha comes into town. He sees these people suffering. And the first thing he got his monks together, and they attended to the people. They brought them food. They attended to the sick as best they can. They made him feel a little better. They made him feel a little bit more comfortable. Then he sat him down and taught him the Dhamma. You know, that's how the Buddha dealt with society. He didn't take up any causes. His cause, and it's a great question because it leads right into what I was hoping to talk about tonight. His cause was to teach people how to end their own suffering. So he attended to this town. I keep wanting to say it's Visali, but it's not. He attended to this town's physical needs. And then he sat the town folks down and he taught them the Dhamma. He said, if you want to end your suffering, this is how you do it. Because to him, that was the most compassionate thing that he could do, was to teach people how to end their own suffering. And that was the reason why that's called the Ratana Sutta, is that Ratana relates to the three refuges. So at the end of his talking to the town, explained to them the Four Noble Truths, explained to them the Eightfold Path, taught them how to do these things, and the monks were going through the town and instructing people one-on-one. And then at the end of a few days, he sat the town down again, and he told them to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. What he said was, you don't worship me. He said, I'm a human being that awakened. I had the same problems you did, and now I don't. So taking refuge in me is recognizing that I'm a human being, and I put all of this suffering aside, and I did it just how I told you. And he said, and take refuge in the Dhamma. These are my teachings. If you want to do this, this is how you do it. In a very simple, straightforward way. And then he said, gather together, and when you come together and talk about my Dhamma, when you come together, talk only about my Dhamma. Put aside all the other things that are distracting you, is what he said. Forget about all the social problems for a few minutes. When you come together as a Sangha, talk about the Dhamma, because the most important thing is to awaken.
And I think that's where I kind of get lost a little bit is, so you spend a few minutes talking about the Dhamma, an hour, whatever, the time we're here, we spend there. And then you want to take something or yourself out into the world, because mm-hmm. those social things still exist.
Yep.
Whatever was going on in their town, I mean, not that they could personally impact the weather that's coming, but there may be structures they can rebuild or whatever. And I guess I was wondering if he was involved in that kind of activity. Like, did he do anything, and I don't mean it as a bad thing, did he do anything other than teach? I was curious.
Not in any, certainly not in any political way, and not in any way that he took a stance on anything except waking up. So, and again, there might be some things that I've missed, but I've never come across that. Maybe it was left out. You know, maybe it was left out of the Pali Canon. But it doesn't seem likely to me. It seemed like his whole focus was to teach people how to put aside all the suffering in the world. That doesn't mean that we should not be involved in the world, but this term engaged Buddhism, I think everybody's heard it. Many people take the idea of compassion, turn it into a Dhamma practice, and feel that if they're just expressing compassion, that's all that the Buddha wanted us to do. And you're missing the whole point. You know, we can... Let me go back and talk a little bit about the Buddha, his awakening, and what he intended to do. So we all know the story about the Buddha, and that he was a prince, was disillusioned and dissatisfied with his life, and at the age of 29, he left the palace grounds in search of understanding. His biggest concern was human suffering, and how can we end it? And so that was his whole goal. That was his focus. A very practical focus. all of the things that we normally engage in as causes are for that same reason. They're for compassionate reason. A lot of times it might be lacking a little bit of wisdom because we're putting too much of ourselves in it. We decide that this is what should be done, rather than spending a lot of our energies on taking to the Dhamma and waking up. And because that, at that point, then we can engage in the world full of wisdom too. So the Buddha taught that compassion without wisdom is likely a dangerous situation. So let me go back so the Buddha wandered around northern India, studying with some of the most advanced spiritual teachers of the time, Alara Kalama and, Udeka, I can't think of his last name. And these were like, they're like Deepak Chopra and Dr. Phil. I mean, I'm just using Deepak Chopra and Dr. Phil because they were a little bit different in their approach. These were the two people that if you were going to learn anything, you're going to learn from them, and you're going to learn their meditation techniques because their meditation techniques were by far the most advanced. So the Buddha studied with Alara first. Pretty quickly, he got Alara Kalama's doctrine down. He learned his meditation technique so quickly and so thoroughly that Alara said, you know, listen, Buddha, I want you to come and teach with me. You know, you really got it. And the Buddha said to Alara, he said, is this all you got, basically? He says, is this your whole Dhamma? Is this your whole doctrine? And Alara says, yeah, this is it. He says, it's not for me. He said, it doesn't lead me to what I'm looking for, which is unbinding. What Alara was teaching was a continued doctrine of self, even though it was in disincarnate realms. He was teaching the Buddha how you can overcome the world by entering into a state of nothingness in your meditation. Of course, the Buddha realized that if I can do that, for one thing, I'm not gaining any insight. And when I come out of this meditation of nothingness, which the Buddha mastered like that, I'm still here. I still got problems to deal with. I'm still prone to sickness, aging, and death. I'm still prone, because of my clinging, to feeling lost when a loved one leaves. I'm still prone because of clinging and aversion when I have to deal with someone I don't like. It upsets me. These are the basic human issues that the Buddha was concerned with. So he went and studied with Udeka, who promised that he really had the answers. And exactly the same thing happened. He studied with Udeka, I think it was name, last name, and he mastered it. This other man, Udeka, taught a meditation technique that brought you to a place of neither perception nor non-perception. Sounds a little bit like nothing. It sounds a little bit like what some of the meditation schools teach today. If you can get into that place of neither perception nor non-perception, Buddha nature will arise. You know, a lot of schools do that. The Buddha said the same thing. He says, hey, Udeka, is this all you got? And Udeka says, yeah, this is it. This is the most advanced teaching. He says, no, it's not it. You're still teaching a doctrine of I. There's still clinging involved in what you're teaching. It's not for me. It doesn't lead to unbinding. It doesn't lead to release. And so the Buddha kept wandering around. He decided maybe it was going to be this severe asceticism. And he met these five other guys that were into the same thing. And that was a common belief in northern India. There was a whole sect that believed that the way to freeing your mind was to deny your body. And that's still around 2,500 years later. There's still a lot of people that do that, that engage in this severe asceticism. Some of it is that you swear off clothes, not because you're so proud of your body, but your clothes are another connection to yourself. You don't eat, you know, you use these breath techniques to slow down your breath, all on the idea of denying your body. And the Buddha tried that. He did it so well that he almost died from doing it. He said that he would eat a couple grains of rice or a couple of beans a day. The Buddha was talking, and it's in the Pali Canon, he said, when I touched my belly, I could feel my spine. You know, that's how skinny he was. It said that his skin was like a gray black from doing these things, and he almost died. A young girl, Sujata, saw him on the side of the road. He had almost rolled into the river and drowned, and nursed him back to health with some milk and rice. Had him feeling a little better. When he started feeling a little better, he said, that's not it either. You know, that's way too severe. Denying the body is not the way. And this is when he started developing what's called the middle way. It's not indulging in every wish that you want, all your sensual desires, and it's also not denying the body. And he started coming to an understanding that there's that the mind is in the body. It's not something that we're trying to escape. He's coming, and the significance of that is he's coming to the understanding that I'm a human being, and the problem is here in my body. These other teachings that were around were about putting yourself into another realm, finding heaven, finding a Buddhist heaven. In that time, these other teachers gained their understanding out of the Vedas, which would grow into Hinduism about 1,000 years later. And he said, that's not it. It's not about escaping this human life. That's not what he wanted to do, because he understood by doing that, he was simply projecting himself into another realm. And he understood that this physical phenomenal realm is just one of those. You know, we can occupy all kinds of different realms, even if it's just in our consciousness or on our imagination. What he was after is how can I release myself from all this clinging, from being bound to this phenomenal world and all of its moment by moment change. And that's when he started teaching about anicca, you know, the impermanence of all things. And he started recognizing that it was his connection to these things, this attachment to all things that were impermanent, that were giving rise to his upset and human's upset. So out of that frustration, a little bit after Sujata got him back to health, he decided, I'm going to sit in meditation until I awaken. I'm just going to sit here. I'm going to bring my body to stillness. And he remembered a meditation technique that he had used as a little boy, 5 years old. And he remembered how calm that this meditation technique brought him. And he started, and this is Shamatha Vipassana that we're going to do in a few minutes. And he sat in meditation. And every attachment, every thought, every desire that the Buddha had came up. And every time it came up, he recognized it. The legend has it that the malevolent god Mara came and attacked the Buddha. Of course, this is going on in his own consciousness. And Mara first threw great armies at the Buddha. The Buddha's sitting here, and armies are coming at him. And this is all just his own fear coming up in his mind. And he sat there. He recognized it as impermanent, recognized that it was an attachment to himself that was giving rise to the fear. He kept coming back to the breath, recognizing all these impermanent attachments. Next, Sujata sent elephants to trample the Buddha. The Buddha sat there, recognizing the fear. Not Sujata, Mara. Next, Mara sent Mara's three beautiful daughters to tempt the Buddha. And the Buddha sat there, recognizing that it was just desire, that he was born out of his ego self that could have given rise to desire. He put it aside, came back to the sensation of breathing. And this went on for 49 days, so the story goes. Every single attachment the Buddha had to anything impermanent, to this ego self, anything that he needed to defend, to keep defining himself, came up. The Buddha put every one of those aside, kept coming back into his breath. As feelings arose, he allowed those feelings to just be there. He didn't react to them. His mind kept quieter and quieter and quieter. This is where he talks about the jhanas. You know, I talked about the jhanas a few weeks ago. He finally settled into that mind of equanimity. He saw reality as it was. He saw all of his attachments as what was causing all his difficulties. His continued doctrine of self that he insisted that that must be protected and proliferated if he was to survive, he realized that there was nothing there. And in a later teaching, he described this self as nothing but foam on the ocean. You know, just blows away. There's nothing here. There's nothing of substance. He let it all go, and he woke up and became a Buddha. And his simple teachings was based on the Four Noble Truths. You know, that's the first teaching he gave. And every teaching he gave for 45 years was based on that. And the only thing he was concerned about was how can human beings put aside suffering? And he understood the problem was as human beings. It wasn't the problem wasn't that we don't have superpowers. The problem wasn't that we can't travel freely to other realms. The problem wasn't that we don't have enough favor from other gods or goddesses or different types of Buddhas. He never talked about any of that. He understood that the problem was clinging. Throughout the Pali Canon, throughout his teaching, when he described awakening, he described it one of two ways. He said, unbound or released. When he described the mind of an awakened human being, he described it as calm. But that strong calm that's settled in equanimity, it doesn't waver. Our minds are there. Even while the world is going on, even while floods are going on and disease is going on, in our day when wars are going on, or all the other awful things that come up every day, we do what we can. We do what's in front of us, but the most important thing we can do as human beings is to awaken. And if we're called to do something because it's right there in front of us, if we're grounded in the Dhamma, we act with compassion that's informed by wisdom. And that's the most important thing. That's how we don't continue the entanglements of the world. So the Buddha was often I can't think of the right word. Whenever the Buddha was traveling around northern India, there were a lot of little kingdoms. You know, there wasn't like one big king of the world up there. There was probably 8 or 10 significant people of power. And as the Buddha would approach these, and the people in power would understand this is a great man, they would try to gain his favor. They'd try to buy him. And the Buddha would always do the same thing. He'd take what he could for the monks, like they would maybe give him a plot of land that he could stay in. Some would build him some shelter, and he would take advantage of that, and then he would teach him the Dhamma. He never got into, you should be doing this, you should be doing that, you know, you got to stop polluting the rivers. I've never come across that. He taught the people in power to treat human beings fairly. Period. He never said you should give up everything you have. He said, but you should distribute the wealth in your little kingdom fairly. That was one of the recurring things that he taught. You should do what you can to take care, as best you can, the people under your charge, you know, in your kingdom. But he didn't take up causes. You know, he dealt with life in a very practical, straightforward way. And I'm not saying you shouldn't take up causes. But the problem is taking up causes as your Buddhist practice, which a lot of people do, and they forget the fact that we need to awaken within the framework of the Eightfold Path. There's very little talk of that, and you know, I don't mean to be putting people down, but I also recognize that there's an estimated 500 million to 1 billion so-called Buddhists in the world today. It's a pretty ineffective Dhamma if there's so few people that are awakened. Or maybe people aren't practicing the Dhamma. Maybe they're more, their identity as a Buddhist is more important than actually getting down to it. So the Buddha was not a Buddhist. The Buddha never identified himself. He insisted over and over again, I'm not starting any religion. I'm teaching human beings how to live best in the world. Period. You know? And so I know you hear me say it often here, the most loving thing that I can do for myself and for all humanity is to awaken. To stop creating some of the difficulties in the world. I don't know that that's likely to happen. The other thing that's important about, an important thing to understand about the Buddha is he never saw himself as a savior for the world. He didn't teach a salvific Dhamma. You know, there's complete freedom of choice. There's nothing that's taken, Charlie and I can talk about this later, there's nothing to be taken on faith, maybe a little bit, but the conviction to put aside all the causes of clinging, craving, desire, and aversion that cause us suffering, that keep us distracted. That's what the Buddha taught. And along the way, if you look at all the ills of the world, there's never been one conflict between nations that isn't exactly the same conflict that people have between themselves. It's defending this ego self. or it's the need to proliferate this ego self, what the Buddha called not self. That self, that thing that you think is you, the Buddha described it as five clinging aggregates. It's made up of five things that cling to each other and cling to the world. And if you take the world too seriously, all you're doing is clinging to the world some more. He said, see it clearly. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't help people in front of us. You know? In fact, if you look at what we do here as a Sangha, we have a pretty powerful impact just in our little corner of the world. You know, with the Donna Dinner and the nurse, the nuns out there. Within ourselves, awakening. I think everybody that's come here and has taken to the Dhamma talks about the power, the powerful positive impact they've had on their own families and their community. Right? That's what the Buddha saw as the most important thing we can do. So again, I'm not saying don't, if there's a cause that's important to you, that's great. But don't let it be a substitute for developing awakening as the Buddha did. The Buddha had a chance to be, his father was a pretty powerful king. He wasn't a minor king. He wasn't one of the big ones either. But the Buddha could have taken over the throne and be in a very powerful position to have to affect social change. But he turned his back on that and took to the Dhamma. Because he understood the most important thing any of us can do is to awaken. And I really believe that for myself. It's one of the reasons why I get so frustrated when I hear about some of the great teachers in Buddhism talking about engaged Buddhism, because I think they have such a powerful effect that the message is lost. You know, that we can just take up the right cause and we're doing good. Well, it's better than something else, but the most effective thing we can do for the whole planet is to awaken. You know? And that's what the Buddha taught. So that was what my... Sorry that I got off onto the speech. But the point that I hope to make tonight was this is a human Dhamma. It's for human beings to take to. You know? And we know that it works because a human being did it before us. The biggest difficulty in awakening that I've seen, I've experienced myself and from teaching and people that I interact with online, is the notion that you need to be something else, that you need to be doing other things besides gaining an understanding of the Eightfold Path. Maybe it's 108,000 bows. I mean, there's a school, and I'm not putting it down, but there's a school of Tibetan Buddhism that before you awaken, you must make 108,000 bows. Again, if you feel that that's important, I have a very good friend of mine that's involved in doing it. It's not all at once. You know, you got this lifetime and maybe a few more. But to me, it's such a huge distraction to practice. You know, this person doesn't meditate at all. There's the biggest school in Buddhism is probably Pure Land, and they tell you, we don't meditate. We don't meditate. We chant. That's all you need to do. They don't engage in the Eightfold Path at all, yet they call themselves Buddhists. And that's fine. They can do what they want. But you're not likely to awaken. You know? Why would you take to it if you dismiss what the founder came up with as the way to do it? You know? So that's my talk on the Buddha's awakening. Are there any questions? I hope I didn't alienate anybody with that. I'm not trying to say don't have a social conscience. You'd be surprised what goes on in my head. But I've learned that the most important thing is every day is to keep my life within that framework of the Eightfold Path. You know, and when I was a much younger man, I mean, I grew up in the time when it was a cool thing to hold up a sign against people that fought for our country. I'm disgusted with myself. I'm not really. I'm over it. But now it was something that I thought was a good thing to do. But what I was doing was I was protesting against people that risked their lives for me. Whenever we take up a cause, there's somebody, another human being on the other side that we're against, right or wrong. You know, when we're against going against the big corporations, well, what are corporations made of? They're made of people. Maybe they're deluded people, but what can we do? it never helped my awakening for somebody to tell me how bad I was. You know? What helped my awakening when I could take the time and settle into the Dhamma. So, again, I'm going on a little bit, but again, I hope I didn't get anybody upset with that. Social causes are wonderful. You know, we need conscious people. The more conscious we are, the better. But there's no substitute for awakening, you know, within the Dhamma. You know, that's what the Buddha taught. Every day the monks would engage in understanding the Eightfold Path, and they'd wander around and teach other people. You know, there's a lot of good things that have been done by Buddhists, you know, sincere Buddhists. But we have to awaken. You know, we have to take to the Dhamma. We have to understand it. That's all. Any questions or comments about this mini rant?
It seems, maybe it's conventional thinking or modern thinking on my part, but it seems wrong for the Buddha to be able to walk away from his wife and family and just say, well, I just want to go and awaken. Like, you know, did he offer to take them? Did they want to go?
No.
Wasn't he worried about them? Wasn't he creating suffering by going out on this journey? Or wasn't he suffering himself?
It's another outstanding question that comes up a lot. Obviously, I don't know what was going on in the Buddha's mind when he realized that he needed to go into homelessness, go forth. It's often described as leaving the world behind, which is exactly what he did. And not all of us need to do that. But there is a tradition within Buddhism. When you become a monk in most Buddhist schools, you are leaving the world behind. That's why you're doing it. And there's plenty of people that have families that became monks because of that strong conviction that they needed, the most important thing they could do was to awaken. So the Buddha realized that if he was in the householder's life, that he couldn't do it. He didn't say that everybody had to leave the householder's life in order to awaken. You know, he taught a lot of lay people, and a lot of lay people awakened during the Buddha's time. But for him, he knew he needed to do that. He needed to go find some answers, and that was the only way to do it. Also remember that the Buddha left his wife and his son in a palace. He was in a rather unique position that he could do something and know that they were going to be safe. But there was also a tradition in northern India of that time that that's what you did. You know, a lot of young men left their homes in search of understanding, and that was respected. It wasn't something that was looked on as, you know, what a freeloader or something like that. You know, they were really respected. That's why that's why you could walk into a town with a bowl and get your food for the day, because people respected what you were doing. So I hope that answers your question. I understand the apparent dichotomy there. How could he leave these people? How could he leave his... And it was a newborn. Rahula was just a baby when he walked out.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems if he was such a great man that he would buck this tradition and realize what was the right thing to do would be.
Well, think about that. If he did that, there'd be no Dhamma. He needed to do... If he didn't go out and... in search of understanding, if he did not leave his wife and his little baby and his father and all of that, all the trappings of the palace, he never would have awakened.
Wouldn't you say that an awakened Buddha wouldn't have done that?
No.
Really?
We're...
And he wasn't awakened when he left.
Right, exactly. That's my point.
Well, an awakened Buddha might not have even had a wife and child. Because those would have been, but he wasn't awakened.
Well, but you're also missing the... we're looking at it from our point of view. Pardon?
See, I would argue that an awakened Buddha wouldn't have done it. Because he would have been awakened, then he would have known.
Well, there would be no reason for him to do anything, but the reason why the monastic tradition developed, and the Buddha had plenty of monks that did exactly the same thing he did. You know, they had to have left their family if they were going to follow the Buddha. Because kind of like what we talked about tonight, the most important thing is to awaken. And I'm not saying we should leave our families in order to do that. But it's an easier way to awaken when you don't have the responsibilities of a family.
You know? And, well, I guess that sort of speaks to the conflict that I have. You know, is it really possible to awaken when you're just living a normal life? I mean, we sort of get glimpses of it, and we can work towards becoming more awakened. But, you know, in the context of just everyday life, it's probably one of the hardest, if not the hardest thing for a person to do.
It is and it isn't. The more established that our lives are within the framework of the Eightfold Path, the closer we are to awakening. And it's entirely possible. The Buddha had a role to fulfill. One of the Buddha's greatest benefactors for at least 25 years was Anathapindika, who was a local businessman who awakened and continued his business. And he gave all through the years, he gave a lot of his money then to the Buddha. But he maintained his position as a businessman, maybe with the idea that this is the best thing I can do. But he was an awakened human being. Another one that I mention a lot is King Ashoka. This is 250 years after the Buddha's death. King Ashoka was one of the most malevolent. He was a modern-day Hitler, or a 2,500-year-ago Hitler. Probably worse. Just a bloodthirsty man. He came across the Dhamma. He awakened, and he became the most benevolent king we probably ever had. And it's because of Ashoka, more than any other individual, that the Buddha's teachings are still here today. He preserved them. So you can certainly awaken as a lay person, as somebody with a family and societal responsibilities. But
in each life, there are probably different times and phases where it makes more sense to be monastic, or it makes more sense to be a householder.
Yeah, and. The idea that there was something immoral or irresponsible in what the Buddha did is coming from a point of view too of how it should be, you know, and we're free to have those views, but then look at where the view is coming from, you know.
But I mean, after his awakening, he put a priority on wisdom and compassion. Where's the wisdom and compassion to just abandon the family?
Well, here's the wisdom and compassion. A few years later, his wife became one of his followers and awakened. And you heard about Rahula, you know. So the Buddha didn't completely turn his back on him. He went kind of like somebody going to college for 5 or 6 years. His father was one of his best friends for the rest of his life. So he didn't turn his back on his family. He went and did what he had to do for all of humanity. And then he spent the rest of his life with his family.
I guess I could understand it more if they knew that going into the marriage, that, you know, maybe there's this possibility that I'm going to leave the family.
Well, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't, but you also have to understand the
otherwise, it's like, you're going away for how long? To do what?
Well, It was an arranged marriage to a distant cousin.
Culture.
Yeah, and they again, I'm not in his wife's head either, but I would in that culture, I would bet that she was very supportive of him. You know, it was what holy men did. We have a different way of looking at it now. You know, not that you shouldn't have that view, but it's interesting how that comes up a lot. How could the Buddha do that? Well, he did it to save humanity. I'm pretty glad he did it. I'm pretty glad he had the guts to leave the palace. I don't know that I would. You know, if my dad was the king of New Jersey and he was giving me everything, I would have never opened up one book. You know, I'd keep taking it because I was so attached to my. But you know, to me, I thought it was a pretty courageous thing for the Buddha to walk away from that. You know, a beautiful wife, a brand new baby. A future king, and he's saying, nope, this is a trap for me.
Was the concept of a walkabout part of their culture too?
Well, most people that did that, most young men that did that, that's what they did. They wandered around wherever they, I mean, that's what they did. They walked. They were wanderers. There's a word that's used that means wanderer. I can't think of it right now, but it was a rather common thing that people did, and a respected thing.
It's known as a Sodom in Indian tradition.
Yeah, but I don't think I don't think that sadhu means wanderer though, does it? Oh, okay, good. Thank you. Wow, it's almost 8 o'clock. So, none of us are likely to leave our families and our responsibilities, but we might, you know. The most important thing is to understand that, again, I've said a few times tonight, just to make the point, that the Buddha did what he had to do to awaken as a human being. And then he gave us a very simple and direct Dhamma of how we could do the same. Wherever we are, whatever situation we're in. And again, the important thing that the Ratana Sutta, you know, we take refuge that a human being did this. He gave us his Dhamma. We take refuge in that. And knowing that if all we have to do is do this, live our lives within that framework. And then spend some time with Kalyanamitas, with spiritual friends. You know, the Buddha said that's the most important thing. He didn't say that we shouldn't have any other acquaintances. You know, the whole of the Buddha's teaching is rest on complete freedom of choice. We can do whatever we want, whenever we want. And if we want to awaken, we can develop an understanding within the Eightfold Path. Yeah. If we feel like we should go live in a cave somewhere for a dozen years, we can do that. If we want to devote our lives to becoming fully awakened human beings so that we can best serve humanity, then we'll be doing what the Buddha wanted to do. You know, that's the Buddha's life. That's the, I know you've heard me say it. To me, the Buddha was the most compassionate human being that I've ever learned about because of that. You know? He turned his back on everything so that he could awaken and so that he could save humanity. You know, although he wasn't a savior, he never presented his Dhamma that way. So here it is. Mm-hmm. If you take to it, this is what you can expect. You can expect to become released from suffering. You can expect to develop a calm and quiet mind. You ain't going nowhere. You know, he didn't teach us how to get out of this. He taught us how to be awakened human beings. And he really he promoted peace wherever he went. He brought an end to conflict wherever he went. Even some of the people that came to the Buddha full of conflict, full of anger, full of hatred, he turned them around on the spot. You know, there's a great story of Angulimala, who wore 100 fingers on his around his as a necklace for all the people that he killed. You know, he was so proud of his killing. And he came across the Buddha. He didn't know who the Buddha was. The Buddha happened to be walking into town. All the townsfolk knew that Angulimala was in the area, and they all locked their doors and stayed away. But the Buddha walked down. He's walking down the street, and here comes Angulimala is going to kill another one. He's going to get, you know, 101. And he saw the Buddha, and he saw the Buddha's radiance, and the Buddha said a few words to him, and Angulimala never killed again. You know, what a powerful impact he had on all the other people that this man would have kept on killing by teaching him the Dhamma. So, that's enough, boy. Sorry for going on so long. I didn't intend it tonight. But shall we meditate? Okay. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.